Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
How do you not know which one's first? It's the doo-wop. We've talked about this.
Oh, you're right. I should have known. I feel stupid now. I could have surmised.
All right. I'll let you explain the doo-wop thing. And then my name's Eric, and I'm here with Michael.
Hi.
Michael is going to explain the doo-wop method of pairing the two films and figuring out their order.
The doo-wop method is when you have two films, and one film starts with, ideally, the article, the. You put that second so that it sounds like a doo-wop group. In this case, Blue Jasmine and the Congress, which is one of the better ones.
Yeah.
Because typically the second film doesn't sound plural or like a group.
Yeah.
But Blue Jasmine and the Congress may be the best doo-wop pair we've come up with so far.
Sometimes they actually sound like Morning Shock Jocks.
Mm-hmm.
Like
Casey
and the Bullfrog or something.
You know what I mean? You could have picked movies we've ever covered.
That's the level I'm at today.
Yeah.
Hey, what about Waiting for Guffman and A Town Called Panic? That has an article that's not a
it
the.
It does, yeah. And I said, ideally, it's a the, because that really solidifies the idea.
But so what you're saying is that show wasn't very good? Not ideal?
No, I didn't say anything about anything. I did last week, but not this week. I didn't say anything.
All right. So we're doing Blue Jasmine, we're doing the Congress, 24 minutes into this show, we're going to be talking about the Congress.
Sure.
That's how long Blue Jasmine will be happening.
If you're curious about our show, this is a show called Double Feature. All will be answered if you just go four episodes back to when we started the year with Citizen Kane and The Godfather. That will give you the bare bones explanation of the what, why, and how within the first 5 minutes of that show.
Yeah.
And then we start spoiling the movie. That's how that goes.
Yeah, we don't say that nearly enough. Thanks for reminding me. I know I tasked you with that.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you're new to the show and you're thinking, where the fuck do I start? There's a million episodes. None of this makes any sense. Start at Citizen Kane and The Godfather. It's the best place to start. Best place. And then you can catch up with this. And if you need more, you can go back and do all of seven.
I had a podcast dick measuring contest today.
All of eight? All of eight. What year are we on? Nine.
All of eight.
Okay.
Nine.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Thank
With
you
who?
For giving us year nine. So I was speaking to two people. We were talking. I'd just seen a while ago, I saw this documentary that came out called Tickled, which, oh my God.
Of course
oh
you did. Of course you did.
But I was talking about this movie and they seemed interested. And she goes, you know, I'd mentioned that I've been doing a podcast. I do a podcast. And she goes, you know, our podcasts are overlapping right now because I do a podcast where I talk about weird people and Tickled is, you know, kind of. And I was like, oh, great. Well, how long has your podcast been running? She's like, well, it's not up and running yet. And I go, huh, my dick is so much bigger than your dick, young lady. And then the guy that she's with goes, I also have a podcast. I'm like, no
God
way.
Damn it.
I go, what's your podcast called? And he's like, it's called The Feed. And I'm like, thinking to myself, I've never heard of this, as if I've heard of any podcast. And I go, how long's yours been going? He's like, oh, only 2 years. And I'm like, man, I got the biggest dick in the room.
And then Joe Rogan walks in. Oh,
well,
sorry.
So he says, he's like, I do it with Rick Bayless. And I go, oh shit, that's like a human. And he goes, because, you know, I'm Dan Bilinski, the food critic for ABC. And I go, oh, shit. Yeah, you got way bigger podcast dick than I do.
Right.
So today we're going to talk about women with big dicks.
good time to get around to the theme. Jesus. You're about as subtle as an Andrew Dice Clay, I think. But don't worry, I'll get to that.
Wow. Yeah.
Can I give you what's on the sheet? It is.
Tell me.
Women forced out of their element.
Mm-hmm.
Are we still feeling that after having
seen the two
movies?
That's the best. That's a really good all-encompassing kind of idea. Are we safely into the Blue Jasmine territory?
Fuck it, we are.
Fucking A.
Roll the Woody Allen font.
Thank you. We're back to Woody Allen. We're back to Woody Allen on Double Feature after doing a journey featuring the man. And this is a good place to be. So I don't know. I don't think I've talked about it much on the air, But since the journey we did with Woody Allen and Spike Lee, I said to myself at the time, I'm going to get way more into Spike Lee, proceeded to watch nothing, and then instead saw every movie Woody Allen ever did, all of them, seen them all.
Wow.
Every single one.
Not how I would have expected you to come out of that.
Me neither. Have not seen Chirac. I've not seen the Old Boy remake.
Seen that either. No.
I didn't see that weird vampire movie Spike Lee did. But I did
now you're
see,
naming Spike Lee movies I don't even
I
know about.
I did see Cafe Society, which came out, I believe, a week ago. I've seen it already.
Man.
That's how on top of Woody Allen I've gotten. And Blue Jasmine is one of the points in his career where he resurged back to the public eye. You know, he's been in and out. And it's also, which this is a testament to a filmmaker. My favorite Woody Allen movie is like his fifth movie back in like 1974.
Sure.
Blue Jasmine, probably my second favorite Woody Allen movie.
Awesome.
How fucking cool is that?
That's great.
How fucking cool that somebody can do a movie 40 years later.
Sure.
And it's their second best movie.
Sure. Sure. Your favorite Kurt Russell movies, your favorite John Goodman movies. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right, exactly.
It's great.
It's just, it's one of those things where for an artist to remain on top of their craft and on top of their game. And really, Woody Allen is often imitated, never rivaled.
Yeah.
His style is so specific. And it's interesting for me to take the outline of, I almost said blueprint, outline of Blue Jasmine, because it takes the classic Woody Allen out of his element doubly, because one, the lead is a female. Mm-hmm. Woody Allen typically doesn't write female leads, at least not since the 80s, not since Mia Farrow. Yeah. And even those were different than this.
Sure.
But also it takes Woody Allen out of New York and out of high society. I mean, it takes Woody Allen out of the place that we've kind of pigeonholed him on double feature.
His only attachment to that is the fact that this character was once in that area
right.
too.
Yeah. Well, and that's, I mean, there has to be a certain biographical element of every Woody Allen movie. And I think that's where this lives.
I hope it's more than the studio made me do a movie that wasn't in New York. And so I was like, man, I just don't know how to function outside of New York.
He had been doing a bunch of movies in London and Paris, right? But Midnight in Paris, you know, titularly. But he has a tendency to become infatuated with places. And Blue Jasmine was this weird return to LA that he doesn't do a lot of.
Yeah. Blue Jasmine is San Francisco, isn't it?
Yeah, sorry, San Francisco. You're
please,
right. You're right.
Please never mix the
you're
two.
Right.
Please.
Blue State's Blue State, man. That's
no.
Blue State's Blue State.
Stop. This is the South over here, all right? I don't know why I'm bragging on right. that, but I am. There is a lot about this movie that, as a Woody Allen movie, is so fascinating, totally separate from anything we've talked about. One is, as you said, the female lead. Actually, female leads, really.
Leads,
I mean, I think.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And also the female-led distress. The fact that the movie it's not oblivious to relationships. Mm-hmm. It does have a relationship in much the same way that a lot of his other movies that are somewhat similar have. Mm-hmm. But the relationship is not the sort of central driving force. I don't want to say it's secondary, because it does push the plot along. It is important to the plot. But I think in a lot of Woody Allen's movies, you get you move scene to scene because of things happening in a relationship, a desire for mm-hmm. a relationship, seeing a dynamic of that. And these are people that are still very much in and talking about relationships.
Yeah.
But I think the thing of primary interest is the lead's distress.
Sure.
Is what is going on with this woman? Right. Is she going to get better? What's happening with right. her, and how is it affecting the characters around her?
And I used the term last week inflammatorily, intentionally, of hysteria. Mm-hmm. And now allow me to backpedal. I use the term because
Michael on Twitter.
Right. I think that the movie if you make the error of not examining it closely enough, could feel like, oh, crazy hysterical woman can't get her footing in the ground after her privilege goes away. But I think that instead, the really interesting thing to look at with Jasmine's life arc, life arc, is that she's kind of, she destroyed her first life, right? So all these people that she's now bunked with in Blue Jasmine in San Francisco, her family, her exes, all that kind of, all the people that used to be a part of her life, she destroyed that life to find her New York life. Mm-hmm. And now she feels like her life is destroyed by returning to the lives she's destroyed. Yeah. You understand?
Yeah.
And I think that there's a really interesting denotation between blatant hysteria and the fact that she can't grapple with the fact that she put all these people down and now has to live with it.
Yeah.
And you get this really, I mean, honestly frightening level of these glimpses of insanity, which are just a testament to Cate Blanchett's performance.
Sure.
When she starts talking to herself, the level of identity I see to just a person on the street, you know, that's, and you know what I mean? The type of person who you walk by and you look at and they're not, they're not in rags and they're not filthy.
Sure.
And instead you look at them and you go, do they have a Bluetooth or should I scoot over?
Sure. Right. You don't know if they're operating in the same plane of reality that you are.
Exactly.
That there's a whole nother room and conversation happening, you know, in their mind.
And
almost the way you know, I've been thinking about that a lot for a totally different reason lately, but it reminds me a bit of when you
money's tight,
are,
huh?
Stop. I've been pretty close to that place, but I think I am much better now. I'll have you know. Where was that? Probably around year three of Double Feature, somewhere in there. I'll have to go back and check. Good thing that one's not up yet. I would say years 3 to 7, maybe. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe 2 to 8. I don't know. Maybe 1 to 10. I forgot where I was going with that as I moved into personal horror. Oh, no. So when you are with somebody, you're sleeping next to somebody or in a room with people or whatever, and you start to talk in your sleep and then you wake up, that is you maneuvering from a world no one is in but yourself to the real world of all of these people. And everyone kind of looks at you and they know you're talking in your sleep. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, they kind of figure that out, but it doesn't ever stop. I don't know if you've ever been caught talking in your sleep. This has probably only happened once or twice in my life, but it is always, sometimes on the phone, actually, maybe more than that. It'll happen. You're talking really late on the phone, you fall asleep. And there's always this reaction of, you know, you sound like a crazy street person right now. You right. must have been talking in your sleep. You know, there's sort of a smile to it. But imagine doing that forever and only having vague flickers, you know, moving between those two planes and never knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a horrifying thing, especially for a Woody Allen movie.
Yeah, well, that's the I feel like, unlike a lot of the Woody Allen movies in existence, but specifically the ones we've covered on the show, there is this dark pang of reality that Jasmine brings to this movie, where there's an almost metropolitan level dissociation that I have with Woody Allen movies, where part of me is...
You're speaking of the film Metropolitan.
Right, Metropolitan, yeah. The film, Metropolitan Friday. I kind of watch a lot of Woody Allen movies, especially the 80s Woody Allen movies, with this, even though they are in very affluent airs, I still pompously watch them like fucking idiots. You think this is a problem, which is, it's funny to me. I mean, it's not necessarily as negative as I just made it sound, but there's a part of me that is not, it's not lost on me that these people are absolutely ridiculous.
You would be doing
socialites.
A Woody Allen marathon on Twitter with a first world problems hashtag after each one. That would be today. We're watching this first world problems. Yeah. Well, there's a high society element to all of them that is.
Yeah.
And I think Woody Allen knows that.
I mean, yeah, it's not lost on him, but I feel like Blue Jasmine is frightening compared to those.
Yeah.
Because it comes from that place of affluence and falls to a place of, if I feel like for me personally, it comes from a place of great affluence, falls to a place of identity, and then shows the trajectory to go below to insanity.
Yeah.
And it makes it feel seamless. It makes it feel frightening, real, and all within the same universe.
Well, and what a powerhouse of a film to take something that usually only exists in the implied, the sort of, this is a Woody Allen film, and therefore there is no God and we'll all die. Now have a good time laughing. And this movie really puts it, you'll be going along having your laughs, and then you find yourself on a park bench. Mm-hmm. And it pushes that reality right in your face at a time when you're not ready or comfortable with it.
Sure.
You then go along eventually treating this character like she's somewhat normal, and then forgetting she, you know, she just slips into a moment of psychosis, and you have to remind yourself, oh, she was doing so well, but she's not, she doesn't have it all together. She is having what is probably more than a nervous breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing as a movie that's interesting is, you know, writing all these female roles, but writing all the character roles. And that's a huge credit to the actors too. I mean, I feel like everybody has a pitch perfect sense of what their character is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, part of that's got to be the writing, but part of it's the acting. It is, I mean, even the Andrew Dice Clay role, actually.
Right.
I would probably not mention him at all in a movie unless there was, oh, look, this is an exceptional thing to talk about. Clay was, actually sent us an email because this is before my time. But if I have a, you ever hear any of his records or anything?
Dude, Andrew Dice Clay is this thing that people talk about. Same as Macho Man Randy Savage.
Okay.
Where people will talk about them and I go, that was
They went
just
to the same parties,
me.
I think.
Yeah. It's one of those things where had I had cable, I would get it. I know I'd get it. But I
believe in a lot of ways.
Except Slim Jims.
In a lot of ways, especially his public perception and the controversy around him. Not in the style of comedy of what I'm about to say, but just in who he was as a personality, he was sort of that generation's Dane Cook. He was a widely celebrated comedian that was also widely loathed by people who saw him as, I don't necessarily want to say lowbrow, but maybe...
douchey.
Certainly there was, I mean, probably that.
Douchey. Douchey.
Yeah. Today he would be, you know.
You said Dane Cook, I get it.
Hashtag men's rights or whatever. But he just kind of had this air of hating women, and the butt of his jokes was often because she has a vagina, you know, that sort of thing.
Sure.
And so.
Which is also, interestingly enough, one of the scrapped themes for today's episode of Double Feature.
Yeah, I think we started out on that level and maybe built it up a little higher. But he had, you know, he just wasn't very subtle in his approach, I think. And I don't want to go too far to Andrew Dice Clay as a fuck, because I think he really nails it in this movie.
Sure. And, yeah, you know, and fucks can't nail it. You're
well,
right.
Yeah. Part of it. No, I see what you did there.
Yeah.
No, I was saying part of it is his character's a little bit of a fuck. Yeah. Just a little bit of that going on there.
Sure. Life imitates art.
Even he, I think, is, if he was putting together a demo reel, I think this goes at the top of his acting work. And so to see everybody firing on all cylinders that way and doing it as characters that you wouldn't necessarily find, not only not in other Woody Allen movies, but not really in the time and space where those movies were, you know, these are on an Earth 2, not an Earth 1.
Sure.
These are characters who wouldn't know those other characters, or a character who fell out of those movies and is meeting the potential audience of them instead or the audience who's watching the game on TV instead of watching the Woody Allen movie on TV. And Jasmine specifically is where so much of that credit goes for having to take on so much of the distress, but also there's an intrigue about her character I have. So let me throw this at you. Do you think that Jasmine has a high or a low opinion of herself?
Probably low, but I think that she has a low opinion of herself, but is accustomed to a higher lifestyle.
Right, right.
Now, she feels like she deserves certain things. Mm-hmm. However, I feel like she has taken things for granted to a point that she doesn't understand that certain things aren't just there.
When she first gets in and she's identified that she's out of that life and she's going to be, you know, just trying to get back on her feet and then go do her thing. I feel like, and I might be wrong about this, but I feel like she has a genuine sense about her that she's better than these people.
Sure.
You know, that even though she is at a point lower than them right now, she doesn't have a place to live and she's fucked with mm-hmm. money and doesn't even know how to spend it correctly and doesn't have any, she still feels, or at least there is a perception that she feels
mm-hmm.
like, well, I'm, you know, I usually sit on top. And I'm going to hang out down and slum it with you guys for a while. But,
right.
you know, let's just keep in mind, I am still high society.
Right. Right.
And I'm not entirely sure if she really believes that, or if when she comes back to town and in conjunction with a bit of the backstory, we're getting the audience in way of the characters think that, oh, here's Miss High Society slumming it with us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it could be that too. I don't know actually if it's either one. I don't know if she really, it seems at times that she may go in and out of that because she's having this breakdown.
Right.
That there's moments where she turns her nose up at things and then other moments where she realizes she's lost things, you know, and has to do something like go to school or learn the computers or, right. you know, do whatever things she yeah. has to do to further her life.
Sure. Like then, get raped by Michael Stuhlbarg.
Well, and then other moments where she just doesn't even know where she is.
Sure.
Sure. Right. She gets cornered, you know, cornered by the doctor. And mm-hmm. that's a huge point of sure. anxiety for her.
Right.
In a way that is.
How about that terrifying beat where she finds the perfect man and then he finds out she has a kid? Almost. And what's interesting about that beat in the film is it almost feels like she's finding out she has a kid too.
Yeah,
it's
does.
Kind of like she is so far gone from who she is.
Well, the most revealing part of her character, which still doesn't necessarily tilt me one way or the other, is the moment where she meets him at the party and he asks, okay, so who are you? What do you do? Tell me stuff about yourself. And she makes things up.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that moment, a totally tempered, maybe a read of the character that doesn't take into account the mental state of the character mm-hmm. would assume that, all right, this is a person who's telling you more about who she wishes she was or who she's on the path to being. And the implication there is she feels a little shame in who she is right now.
Right.
And I guess that comes down to whether you feel like she builds that life in her head and then lives it and then needs to be reminded later that's not who she is, mm-hmm. or that she is in a sort of denial for so long about her mental state that she can't, you know, it becomes too late. It becomes a real fuck you ending by the end to go, it's too late now. You lied to yourself for so long that you're past a point where you can help yourself.
Yeah.
And now you will permanently live in this state of, I don't know.
Right.
Does that cover everything about Blue Jasmine? Every last
Hell
thing there
no.
is to talk,
Hell no.
to talk about?
But also absolutely. So the Congress, I semi-prefaced something and then I thought it may be better to just tell you while we're, you know, fuck it, we're doing it live.
Yeah, you like to do our show before we go on the air.
Yeah. So the Congress, we've done a lot of movies on Double Feature. Done a lot of them. We've done
Act.
And to this point, we've done both Shane Carruth movies. We've done both of them.
Right.
Maybe not definitively, but in the top three, the Congress may be in the top three most difficult movies we've ever covered on Double Feature.
this is so interesting to me. Difficult like how?
We talked about this a little last week, coming from a show that did the definitive and quintessential explanation of exactly what goes on in Mulholland Drive. This movie is just one of those things where I'm watching it. And again, something we talked about last week, I find myself going, I guess we're doing this now, and have to go, okay, wait, we've been doing this to the point where this is actually a thing. How does this apply? What is the idea? It's so dense and it's so specific, and the sci-fi elements are so unforgiving in a Naked Lunch sort of way, but even harder. I mean, Naked Lunch, like in it, it's as difficult as Naked Lunch, the book, not even Naked Lunch, the movie. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those things where I get to the end of the movie and I look back on it and I go, Jesus fuck, I sure hope I know what happened.
Uh-huh.
I sure hope I understand what happened.
Yeah. You get a sort of performance anxiety about the show.
It's not.
You want to go listen to someone else talk about it for 24 minutes.
it's not. And it's because of the format of our book club for movies idea that we do. I know I can talk about the Congress for 24 minutes, but I can't confidently say I'm talking about the Congress knowing what the fuck really happens in the Congress for 24 minutes.
Yeah.
I think I have a nebulous idea. Anyway, all of that aside, it makes it one of the most exciting things we've covered on Double Featuring forever, because I feel like, to a point of certain back padding, we have gotten so good at movies that we know them. You know, we can figure out what's going on. We're able to find a through line in even a film like A Town Called Panic. But with the Congress, and this is actually kind of where I wanted to end this little diatribe. Earlier this year, in the first episode, the Citizen Kane episode, I made a joke that I then ruined by overusing in the following episode, where I said any movie can be described as Citizen Kane plus, you know, some other element.
Right.
And now here we are in the fourth episode of year nine, and I think the Congress is an example of a film that has nothing to do with Citizen Kane, even remotely. There's no part of it that you go, it's like Citizen. It's kind of like Citizen Kane, but without Citizen Kane and more like the Congress.
Yeah. Yeah. It shows a long view of someone's life, I suppose. That is one of the central things I think about in Citizen Kane. But this is not a double feature of the Congress and Citizen Kane. So thankfully, I don't need to find any parallels there.
Yeah, right.
And quickly, in regards to your patting on the back of our ability to approach films, I'm going to teach people another film approachability tactic, and I don't even think we're going to use it here. But anytime I get so freaked out by a movie, I'm afraid of even talking to another human, specifically mostly you on our show, about it. The questions are so basic. Who, what, where, when, why? Maybe how, you know? You try to talk about ideas as the highest form of conversation over events and lower than individuals.
Right.
And so, you know, sticking to ideas is going to let you tackle most broadly and take the most things away from a film. We're also interested in filmmaking. So, and I don't know if events can even be talked about on the show. So we do a little bit of both.
Sure. And why don't we go ahead and do individuals? Robin Wright Penn, what the fuck? Where was this? You know, why did nobody talk about this while Cate Blanchett was getting her Academy Award? Robin Wright Penn did this. And there's this kind of joke in the beginning where they go, yeah, you're washed up. Princess Bride was 20 years ago. And then I believe 6 months after the Congress, House of Cards happened.
I know. I kept thinking that. I was like, you guys, did you all rush to put this movie out before House of Cards? Or did they go, oh, fuck, now no one's going to see our movie because House of Cards?
Right.
I think I heard about this after House of Cards had already been a thing. So it was immediately just funny. As somebody who was on Director's Cut, which was about Missy Pyle playing herself, everybody wonders, well, what's going to happen with Missy Pyle's career immediately following this movie? Mm-hmm. You know, it has the real world has so many implications on the jokes you've written and the things in relation to that. She goes through this movie that is such a head trip that you need some method of tackling it. Mm-hmm. And I usually start there when I don't have another way, because that at least lets me see the pieces that I'm moving around. Mm-hmm. And it provides simple one-word questions that you can just answer yourself. And by doing that, you started to figure out, you know, when we were doing our early shows, I would feel like, especially in the second or third year, we would only figure out what the big themes, what the big revelations in a movie are once we talked about the movie for so long. And mm-hmm. that's why, you know, our shows tended to be a lot longer. Is it would take a while for us to just show up and go, okay, wait, what? Mm-hmm. What's coming out of this?
But, what are they getting at with Constantine?
Right. But that might have taken more years, I think, to figure out. Constantine
maybe a
ends,
whole new TV show.
Right. Constantine ends with Shy watching it in a theater 5 years later, back to back with all his other films and weeping into a webcam. That's what happens there. It's a shame we don't get to talk about events like that on Double Feature. This movie tackles a lot of different things. I'm going to throw big ones out at you, and you could just tell me where the fuck you want to go in this swarm of nuts. One, strange 70s acid animation world. Two, I drink your milkshake. Three, flying kites in a hangar, being an actor, talking to the film industry and seeing the relationship between the film industry and an actor. The part that I think the entire beginning of the movie is preoccupied. Do you want to start there? Or do you feel like, when you leave the Congress, what's the big thing that you're going, okay, I really need to think about what they were saying about this or how they did this?
I think, well, the one thing for me about the Congress that I really walk away wondering is its commentary on the trajectory of escapism.
Whoa.
There's a lot of little things, but that's really that. And then that also from the, like you said, we like to think about filmmaking that plays into the, is this animated? 'Cause it's cheaper.
right. Maybe but, is the answer.
Right.
You're right, though. I thought about that, too. I went, you had Robin Wright, and then you could be like, listen, you're just going to act for a couple scenes, and then we're going to do the animation. Although I will say when we come back to her
playing herself
at the end, I'm just going, oh, yeah, there's a reason I love your acting, because you do acting.
Right.
And in the animation, you're still with her, but what's happening there is the animation is crazy, and you're looking at it all and trying to figure out what's going on. Sure. You're not there sobbing with her. As much as seeing her, you know, in Children of Men at the end of this film.
Yeah, right. Well, and so the kind of idea of the escapism of this movie is so weird because it is privatized. It is big business. It's legalized. They use the term drug, but I don't feel like they're talking about drugs the way that we talk about them in 2016.
Yeah.
They're not talking about taking the edge off with a little weed. That's not what they're talking about. They're talking about the kind of drug that is more akin to a Banksy painting of a TV that just says God on it. That's the kind of drug they're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where they're talking about this level of what somebody who's, you know, older now may, you know, think about children who have smartphones, you know, that kind of thing.
Sure.
That's the mentality of escapism and drugs, big, you know, quotations, where it's the idea of taking yourself out of the immediate and real place you're in and mm-hmm. putting yourself into a more specific and surreal and ideal in a lot of ways place.
Yeah.
Well, a place where everybody is and everybody gets to be and do and say what they want, which has proven dangerous with something like the internet in some ways, you know?
Right. And
they really don't dabble in that in this movie.
No, they don't.
There's not a lot of the comment section doesn't exist in the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Instead, it's kind of the higher ideas and the whole notion of, especially when the final stage of the drug is introduced, what if you could just, you know, Matrix style, but still with more control, unplug from the shitty life where you have to eat and shit and instead be literally whoever you want, whatever you want, wherever you want, and you know, just what you want. To go back to your questions about how to find the basic elements of a movie, you get to take this drug and then someone goes, who, what, when, where? They don't ask why, and they don't care how, because the drug is the answer to both of those other questions.
Yeah.
And you get to be and do whatever you want. And so there's this kind of commentary that extrapolates from acting being a root of escapism. And then furthermore, films being a root for escapism for the greater masses. This feels very cathartic having this conversation right now. I feel like I'm actually gleaning the movie. Ta-da. I feel like I'm seeing it for the first time.
Yeah. Well, I want so much to talk about this element of filmmaking, not even just because of the commentary, but also because the film itself seems so preoccupied with it.
Right.
Seems, to create all of these little homages and try and figure out what the fuck is happening with Tom Cruise and what that even is supposed to, what the joke's even supposed to be there other than.
Were you shocked that that wasn't Adrian Brody?
No. I looked at it and went, yes, Tom Cruise, bomber jacket, the eyebrows.
No, not that guy. John Hamm's character.
Oh, right.
Sulking in all the scenes. Yeah. I'm is that Adrian Brody?
Yeah. They, in some backwards world, they animated it for Adrian Brody and it just didn't work out. Yeah. So the movie both talks about filmmaking and then also in a way we've described before of a meta film saying that the filmmaker has a bit of a preoccupation with how movies are made and the craft and the process. And, you know, they're speaking from their daily life quite a bit. I think that's the case here. So all throughout, there is a mixture of what I believe is two things. One is the reference culture business of film, and considering how that interfaces with technology and how it exists on a longer timeline. The other is seeing that timeline in a way that I don't think we see something like the Matrix is a good example. I would say, really, I would say any movie that at its core goes, and then the robots became self-aware, so this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of movies that predict into the future, I mean, this is everything you need to know about these two outlooks. This movie takes a different path from the outlook.
What
that
if then what?
Yeah. I mean, doesn't it feel like any movie facing the future kind of goes, and then this event happens and it changes it. And it's not always, you know, apocalypse
Skynet
event.
Or,
but
Yeah.
It'll be a Skynet. It'll be
what?
That's a
Todd Solondz joke. What if then what? You haven't seen the movie yet, but it's
no,
a joke.
I haven't. I'll laugh at it anyways. That's fine. Mm-hmm. You amuse me more than anything we actually say does. So I just like that you're having a good time.
I'm your pompous high society chuckling. Right. You know that everything I say is just inane and ridiculous. So you just laugh because I'm here at all.
Yeah. You're an abstraction in a tiny window on my computer. I mean, I don't even know if I'm really doing this right now or sitting on a park bench.
Sure. Flying a kite.
They talk about overpopulation, or they talk about shortage of food, or what if the earth became all water and we had to pee in a filter? That was additional content, I think is what that one was. But even look at all those movies. They're all going, because in the future, after X event happens. So now that we know what the movie's not, my guess at what the movie is and why it doesn't share really anything in common with those is because it's not looking at an inciting technology or a single event. It's looking back at how humans have fell out of a way we once saw them. And if they continue to, I think it is a little cynical. If they continue to fall, maybe that's too cynical, but if they continue down, let's say the path, they continue to move the way that they have been moving. We go from being preoccupied with, we go from the 50s when everything was white and great, as I'm told. And then we get TVs and it ruins everything and the immigrants come in.
And then everything was black and white and great.
Right.
And then there was Vietnam and it was black and white and red all over. Yeah.
God damn it. Listen, my point is that we start getting pieces of technology and they make society worse, which is actually never my point, but perhaps the point of the movie. That we don't catch up to how to deal with this technology right. before the technology gets here.
Right. Kind and of suddenly, the Nobel Dynamite thing.
A little bit.
Yeah.
You know, we create these phones that can use the internet, and we didn't really think about what if you had internet everywhere in your pocket, how is this going to change things? Or to go back to the comments, we create this universal video sharing site. What happens then? Mm-hmm. And no one really saw sure. coming that.
Or what if anybody can say whatever they want with zero ramifications?
Like sure.
What if that's just a place we live?
A byproduct of a byproduct yeah. in that case, I think.
Yeah.
Wikipedia, the encyclopedia, anyone can edit, you know, starting to have wearable technology. If right. that takes off further, you know, bringing the internet more into your body.
I think actually Wikipedia is a really good place to operate in the mental state of the Congress mm-hmm. because where the comment section is, look at how bad people can be when they're not held to a certain standard. Wikipedia gets to be the place where minds go, this is a fact. And then other greater minds go, actually, that's not a fact.
Yeah.
And yeah. the end result is a cultivated and curated encyclopedia of the greater extent of human knowledge.
Sure.
With a few, you know, shitty articles about high schools and their gym teachers.
I think on the whole, that's a positive experiment. Although I have sure. many serious qualms with it.
Yeah.
I think that considering how large of a project and experiment it is, a successful one.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the post-humanist consideration of this movie, if you ever want to figure out, okay, so there's going to be a group
man,
of post-humanists
we're just using
having
so
a little
many great thematic. Man, this is
well,
this
I
is
wanna,
a this is a Pulitzer Prize-winning episode
listen,
of Double
listen,
Feature.
I don't want it to sound like if I told you there was a room of post-humanists, go in there and talk to them. If you're the type of person who goes, what the fuck is that even? I don't even
would
know
I
what they would
animated?
Be talking about, right? Would I be animated? These are the concerns of post-humanists to look at this and go, well, guys, we detached ourselves from reality with the TV, and then we detached ourselves further with the cell phone. And perhaps, you know, as our technology grows, society's laws
sure.
certainly, but
a
also it's
part of our individual self.
Before we're ready for it, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Before
mm-hmm.
we know. You know, we see that law falls further and further behind as technology. It just has no fucking clue what to do about it, and it's not getting any better. But even society isn't quite sure if the day cell phones with the internet, or really the iPhone, if the day the iPhone came out, everybody who saw an article about it or whatever also mm-hmm. saw side by side what the future would look like, you know, in mm-hmm. 6 or 7 years.
Sure.
Right. I think we would have gone, okay, well, we need to set places and times that we just have decided we're not using our phone. No phone mm-hmm. time. That would have been the first fucking thing anybody did. And we would have figured out cars and phones a lot earlier before mm-hmm. everybody killed people posting on their Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And the concern there of one potential concern, people who think about far distant futures and where humans are going and their relationship with technology and fiction, where they're 3D, they're 4D, where they're Oculus Rifting. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's another one that
sure.
3D gaming has come along before we even need or know what to do with it.
Right. Something like VR is impressive too, because when VR becomes popularized, you know, the next thing that happens is VR gets smaller. And the smaller mm-hmm. something gets, the more, you know, physical it becomes, until eventually there's the you know, overarching idea of until it's a chip that they
sure.
shoot into your eye or that they inject into your neck, and then you can go on the internet by thinking about it.
Sure.
It's the failed Google Glass experiment.
Yeah, right. Well, that was another
just
one.
Always
that,
fucking there.
Yeah.
That's the thought.
We knew we could create that if we really sat down and thought about it, but we didn't know the implication. And so this movie is experimenting with, all right, well, if we had the ability to create a digital version of you and you could live on forever, what would businesses do with that? Well, they may require that they own your persona and then you never act. So there's mm-hmm. one consideration. There's
sure.
also the fact that things hit the public domain. We've always celebrated that as great because, you know, 50 years later, nobody, fuck you guys. We want to be able to mess with this. But does that mean actors who last acted 50 years ago, in theory, if we could digitize them from that performance, we would be allowed to use them as actors in our movie today?
I guess so, yeah.
That's a weird boundary, and that's something mm-hmm. the film's playing with.
Sure.
And then to go, you can actually consume and be right. and the fantasy element of it.
It becomes this interesting question about acting in general, where is the performance in and of itself really fiction?
Yeah.
Or is it a fictional element of a real person, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what Robin Wright as a character in the Congress knows going in. It's a head-to-head thought. She goes, yeah, I mean, you're saying that, like, you can use my likeness and then I can be in all these movies, but I don't think you're realizing that there's a personal element to the performances and the fact that my real being there is an implication. The fact that I even agreed to do a film is an implication of me as a human.
Sure. That becomes
The opposite is, it's just like when you look at Nicolas Cage, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that Nicolas Cage agreed to do a movie means fucking nothing except that there was a paycheck. It doesn't mean the movie's good. It doesn't mean he intends to do a good job. It just means he's going to show up.
Sure.
Whereas somebody like Daniel Day-Lewis, he shows up, you know that there's a reason. He doesn't show up for no reason.
Right, right. You go, this is a serious thing that mm-hmm. we're going to really need to sit down and pay attention to. Yeah, even just their choices, you're right, and their performances. But the scarier other half of that is, as an actor, as a high-minded art fuck, you like that. Does society really give a fuck? If most
Back
actors...
Back to Nicolas Cage. Nobody cares. Well, everybody's still down with Nicolas Cage.
If you look at the top grossing films of this year, and 90% of them, it turns out, were CG performances, mm-hmm. I don't think people would really be that surprised or care going sure. forward.
Right.
They could just as easily, you know, be that. And so that's a consideration. And then the movie pushes, you know, forward. It keeps going logical conclusion. How far does this go until society just fucks itself out of existence, until fiction and reality become the same?
And then it just goes, escape, don't think about it.
Right. The last time I considered this with somebody, someone was talking about a world in which we had sexual companions that are essentially robots that are better at being sexual partners than human beings. Mm-hmm. And if you just approach a conversation like that, well, how would that change human dynamics? Would we stop procreating? And then some hippie in the corner goes, but there's a human behind there and that's important. And all the post-humanists go, shut up, get out of this conversation.
Right.
That looks like a silly conversation to have, but I think the value in post-humanism is to remember that people were not having the what is the implication of self-driving cars conversation, because it seems silly and in the future, and now it's here, and mm-hmm. we're going, oh fuck, what do we do about this?
Yeah, right.
So, you know, that stuff is always right around the corner. Now that we've opened all those boxes, though, let's get the fuck out of the show.
This is a dense pair of movies. This is a good show.
Yeah.
Other good shows exist at doublefeature.fm. If you don't believe me, tell me, doublefeatureshow@icloud.com.
Great. Or maybe make some tweets. David B. Anderson, Greg Winner, Aaron Shore, Kimberly Yance, Debbie Starin, Meta Somerville, David Koch, and Lexi Love. What are we doing next time?
Are you ready for this year's journey? Are you ready?
Let's make it happen.
All right. The journey, the title, we'll get into it next week, but the overarching theme is War and Peace, and where better place to start than with fucking Top Gun and Dazed and Confused?
You'll get 5 other stabs at it, don't worry. Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.